You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there have been a few changes to the 2020 presidential candidate roster. We'll look at who's in, who's out, and what they're all up to before the next set of Democratic debates. Now, Reddit co-founder Alex Ohanian recently wrote a piece in the New York Times telling the story of how crucial paternity leave was for him and his family. Ohanian is the husband of tennis legend Serena Williams, who suffered life-threatening medical complications following the birth of their daughter in 2017. In his piece, he wrote that prior to his daughter's birth, he hadn't thought much about paternity leave, but was ultimately grateful he had the opportunity to stay home with his family. In the United States, many fathers, if they even have that kind of leave, don't take time off to help with the care of their children after they're born. According to at least one survey, many men felt as though they could lose their jobs or wouldn't have support in their workplace. Our next guest is here to talk about the state of parental leave, how to reduce the stigma for dads who take it, and the benefits of fathers taking time off to help raise a baby. Stephanie Kuntz is the Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families and Emeritus Faculty of History and Family Studies at the Evergreen State College. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob.
We have this prominent person writing this op-ed, famous kind of in two different directions there. What are your thoughts on what he had to say?
Well, I think it's extremely important. This is usually seen as a woman's issue. But first of all, it's a family issue because 40% of households rely on women's earnings for all or at least half of the income that they get. Secondly, it's a family issue in another way as well, because men's involvement is extremely important to the well-being of the family, to the well-being of kids, and to the well-being of the partnership. And there's just massive evidence of the benefits of paternity leave in terms of giving men hands-on experience at home that then lasts for years afterwards. It reduces, men generally do much more housework and childcare if they've taken adequate paternal leave. It reduces conflicts between husbands and wives over chores. It increases, one of the things that I think is most striking in terms of future gender inequality is that young boys who see their fathers doing that kind of hands-on work are much more likely to do it themselves, even no matter what the parents say. They learn to practice what the fathers practice, not just what the fathers preach. And in families where the father takes leave, several studies in Europe and have shown that girls are assigned fewer household chores afterwards. The idea breaks down that, oh, it's the girls who have to do the chores and the boys who get the larger allowances, even though they don't do the chores, which is still the pattern here in the United States.
We heard from Dave on the Ideas Network Facebook page who says, compared to European paternity plans, we're still in the Stone Age. I'm not sure how things actually worked in the Stone Age, but that said, Stephanie, what are our paternity leave laws like here in the United States?
Oh, they're completely inadequate. I think that I forget how many people have it, but like 7% of men have actual guaranteed paternity leave. And it's just a scandal. I mean, we're bad enough with maternity leave, but it's even with paternity leave. And the fact, one of the things that we're finding from studies of Quebec and Norway and other countries is that if you make paternity leave totally voluntary, men won't take it. They want it. They will tell you that they want it. But that, as you said earlier in the introduction to the program, they're afraid that they, and with good reason, there are real penalties often against men. If they do that, they're seen as not really committed workers. But when paternity leave becomes a use it or lose it kind of thing, as it was in Quebec and Norway, then men start taking it up. In Iceland, in 2000, men accounted for only 3% of parental leave days. But by 2007, they took a third. And then when they extended the father's leave quota to 6 weeks, by 2006, 70% of eligible Norwegian fathers were taking almost all the time for which they were eligible. So you can see that you've got to have policies that don't just make it something exceptional that somebody can request, but that we take it as a norm, just as we take as a norm that women should be able to stay home, that men should be able to stay home, and that's part of their responsibilities. Breadwinning is not their only responsibility.
Talking to Stephanie Kuntz from the Evergreen State College, author of the book Marriage, A History, looking at family leave in the United States, an op-ed by Serena Williams' husband, the founder of Reddit, calling for more leave for women, but particularly more family leave for men. Let's talk about that stigma you were just mentioning, Stephanie, perceived and I guess real. Why is it out there in the workplace against men taking that paternity leave, even if they happen to have it?
Well, there's a really interesting thing that happens in terms of prejudices against men and women. Employers tend to assume that a woman, the minute she becomes a mother, will not be as dedicated to her work. Even if she keeps the same hours and the same productivity, there's a real motherhood penalty in terms of promotions, pay raises, this sort of thing. They just assume, oh, well, women will pay more attention to their family. Men actually get a fatherhood bonus. And a marriage bonus at work, because the employer assumes that when a man has a child, he will work even harder and longer hours to make up for the fact that his wife can't contribute to the income, and that he knows that he has this new responsibility of a child. The flip side of that fatherhood bonus, which I think you could say was also I'll call a non-parenting incentive, is that when a man then does say, well, I would like family leave, he is perceived as kind of like a woman in the very bad sense of the word, that he's perceived as weaker, he's perceived as someone who's not as committed to work, he's penalized for promotions in the long run and pay raise, and sometimes even bullied at work. There are studies that show that there's this increase of teasing that shades into bullying. So you have to make it something that is normalized. And if we don't do that, men are understandably going to be very reluctant to take that risk.
Do you see, obviously this isn't in federal law particularly, but do you see companies taking the lead and making that kind of family leave policy and that use it or lose it, as you were talking about, so that it's an incentive to actually use it instead of that option that a lot of men don't take?
More companies are doing that. Unfortunately, as you know, we have a very unequal wage system and working condition system in America. And so the people who might need it the most, the people whose wives are, you know, low-income families where both are working, where the wife may have the kind of medical problems that or not have enough leave, these men are much less likely to get paternity leave, just as their wives are much less likely to get maternity leave. This really has to be, I admire the companies that are instituting it, I applaud them for it, but we really have to take some responsibility for this as a society. We don't ask individuals to pay for the section of the road that they're going to use. And it seems to me that you know, roads are a big investment that is a social investment. We understand that. This economy won't work without them. Well, kids' well-being is a social investment, and family stability is a social investment. So I think this needs to be done at a national level.
We're talking to Stephanie Kuntz right now, Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families. She's with us to talk about the state of family leave, paternity leave in particular in the United States, why it's not available in many places, and why fathers often don't even use it when they have it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think in general the U.S. needs more family leave for moms and or dads? And if you're a dad in particular, if you wanted to take that family leave, maybe with the arrival of a newborn, but felt you couldn't, either because you didn't have it available to you or you felt that pressure at work that if you took even what you could, it could hurt your career, your paycheck. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we continue our conversation about the state of parental leave in the United States, especially when it comes to dads, after a new op-ed by the founder of the website Reddit, who's the husband of Serena Williams. He talked about his experience as a dad with family leave, made the case for more of it. Stephanie Kuntz is with us, Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts, what questions do you have about family leave? What would you like to see change when it comes to more people, moms or dads, taking parental leave? And for the dads out there, did you have the opportunity to take time off when you had a newborn in the house? Did you do it? Were you able to? What was the experience like? Or do you wish you had had the opportunity to do that, but you didn't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stephanie, one side benefit I've seen an argument, if dads take family leave, it can actually help with the pay gap that faces women because they don't have to take all the time off for the family leave, and it doesn't interrupt their career as much as it otherwise might.
Actually, that's a very important point, because people are afraid, you know, often men are the higher earners in the family, and families are afraid to have the man take pay because there's often a pay reduction, even when some of the wage is made up for. But there's a new study out of Norway that shows that when men do this, it is true that they do lose a little bit in terms of immediate promotions and raises, but that's outweighed by the amount of extra income the woman moves in, is able to bring in over time because of the fact that she's been able to go back to work earlier, or at least has not had to take off all the time whenever the child is sick and may go in and out of the workforce. So the family wage turns out to be better off.
And you mentioned earlier, Stephanie, people at the lower end of the wage spectrum. I think a lot of times when we think of family leave issues, we picture the white-collar workplace. What do you see in countries, say, European developed countries, when it comes to family leave for those lower-wage workers?
Well, because it's a national policy, these people get this leave, and they don't necessarily always get the same level. I mean, they get the same level of replacement. It's not always as much as the higher-paid workers, but often in many countries, the government will step in and step it up a little bit to make it more possible. It's extremely important for these. In Sweden, they had a study that showed that when they instituted this family leave, it meant that, and I think this is especially true for lower-wage and higher-stress workers, that there were that the mother's and the children's health was better, because when the mother had even a simple illness, not something as bad as Serena Williams had, but she had to then take care of the baby, this really hurt her, that it made there were more trips to the hospital, more medications were necessary, whereas this new Swedish law that allowed the men to take off a couple days at a time, even if they didn't take the entire paternal leave all at once, really assuaged the stress in these families and actually led to better health outcomes for the mothers, which meant that they could go back to work more and less anxiety in the family, which is always anxiety like that is always passed on to the kids. So
one likely reaction to this might be in the United States, Stephanie. Okay, yeah, this all sounds nice. It also sounds really expensive. Is it?
Well, you know, we have to have priorities. We've got tax cuts that are costing us billions of dollars. And, you know, this is a minor aspect of this. I haven't done the math for this particular one. I can do it to you and send it to you later. But it's really not something that is should be a major expense. I mean, we need to say to ourselves, what are the payoffs? We know that, for example, investing in preschool and investing in child care has huge payoffs in terms of children's development, saving long-term costs in terms of educational failure, ability to hold down jobs. It's the same thing with this kind of investment in families. Those are our most important resource. I'd sure rather spend my the share of my taxes paying for that than for an arms race or whatever.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi. Great topic. I think it's an excellent idea, but I'm a workaholic, so when I had my kids, I could take off, like, they gave me a week off, but I only took one day off because I just can't be sitting around, and I just can't be at home, like, that long, and plus the pay, too. I mean, I couldn't really afford to pay it, but, like, I recently took 3 days off, and it drove me nuts, so I had to get back to work, so.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Stephanie, Nick's probably not alone, particularly among guys that feeling like, no, I got to be out there at work, even if, as in this case, Nick had, well, as long as a week.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I just think that we need to think that through. I tend to be a bit of a workaholic myself, and I'll tell you, it was sometimes difficult for me to be with that kid instead of being out doing some, quote, productive work. But I just got an email from my son that suggests to me that it was pretty productive work being able to spend time with him. You don't have to devote yourself full time. You can do some work from home, you know. But just being there and being able to respond is going to make a big difference. You know, maybe he has the kind of marriage where the wife is perfectly happy with him doing that kind of work and being away, and he will not regret at a later age, maybe that he doesn't know his kids as well as his wife does. But it's quite strongly possible that when we look at the statistics on average, that this is a risky thing to do for your relationship with your partner and with your kids.
Nick, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Stephanie Kuntz from Evergreen State College, looking at family leave in the United States, especially paternity leave. Let's go to another caller now. We've got Eric on the line in Milwaukee. Eric, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Eric?
Yeah, my company offered 6 weeks of paid paternity at 60%, and then in Wisconsin I was able to take another 6 weeks of unpaid leave, which I was able to do it periodically. So I basically went to part-time. So I spent 12 weeks at home at 60% pay with my brand-new daughter, and it was the most rewarding time of my life. If I had to do it again, I'd do it in a heartbeat.
All right, Eric, and can you talk about, you know, what was it like to be – well, actually, no, let's – did it feel like it hurt your career potentially when you came back?
It didn't, actually. I didn't feel that way, especially since after the 6 weeks I went to part-time, so I was able to catch up. I still kept in touch, but it really depends on your priorities. Even if it did hurt my career somewhat, it helped me and my family.
Eric, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. Stephanie, what do you think?
Well, I think that this one is statistically correct. I mean, everybody has exceptions, right? You can't run your life by averages. But in fact, we find that when men do this kind of leave-taking, it decreases their arguments with their wives for months afterwards. It decreases their chance of divorce for at least 6 years into the future. Means that they, and the big thing is, you know, men have been kind of sidelined. We talk about, there's another kind of fatherhood penalty, and that is that men have been second-class citizens in the family, just as women have been second-class citizens historically at work. And they, as long as they never get the chance to do it themselves, as long as they're just the kind of unskilled assistant helping out in the home with mom, they never learn the joys and the necessities of what it takes to be a real hands-on father. And so I think that your caller is really talking about an investment in the future that pays off dividends even after he goes back to work full-time.
Thanks a lot again for that call. Stephanie, part of the story here you're talking about is changes in laws and company policies, but it also sounds like it's a cultural change. Do you see that culture change at least starting to happen in the United States?
Well, I keep hoping. I do think that when they do polls of younger people, there's a considerable interest, a bigger interest than there was 20, 30 years ago in people of same age, of having more time to balance work and life activities, whether it's family or whether it's just being an individual who has a life outside work. We in the United States have developed this. It's actually fairly recent. It's not something we've always had. You know, remember, we used to talk about bankers' hours. Bankers' hours were people like those because you came in at 9 or 10 and you left at 3. Now bankers' hours are, you know, never go home at all if you can help it. So this has been a change really just since the 70s. During the 60s, Americans actually took more vacation time than Europeans. So something strange has happened. It's not built into our history, and we can turn it around if we actually sit down, take a few days or a few minutes off work, and think about what life would be like if we weren't all so stressed about it.
Well, what would it take then to accelerate that change if we decide that's something we want to do?
Oh, boy. You're good at asking really hard questions. I think it's a question of just doing the priority. I don't have any magic solution. But when you ask the question right, you usually do get an answer. When the question is, how can we afford to do this? Oh, my gosh, how would this get done? You're never going to get to the answer. When your answer is, how can we develop a society where men and women have time to renew themselves at home, which allows them to renew themselves at work. And there are lots of studies that show that when people do take time off, they're actually more productive at work than when they're constantly working all the time. So this should not be, you know, rocket science. This should be just logical kind of human organization, and we can figure it out together.
Stephanie, thanks as always for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
That's Stephanie Kuntz, Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families and Emeritus Faculty of History and Family Studies at The Evergreen State College. She joined us to talk about the state of parental leave in the U.S., specifically benefits for families for when fathers take time off to take care of children. Coming up, Joe Walsh, former congressman, announced he would challenge Donald Trump for the Republican presidential nomination, while two more Democrats have dropped out of the race on that side. We'll talk about the comings and goings in the 2020 presidential campaign and ask what and who you're paying attention to. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, it's one of the best-loved books in American literature, and it's got a new movie version out in 2019. Keeley Bultina and her guests look at the staying power and influence of Little Women. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, over the weekend, former Tea Party Republican congressman from Illinois, Joe Walsh, announced he was going to challenge Donald Trump for the party's nomination.
I'm running because he's unfit. Somebody needs to step up, and there needs to be an alternative. The country is sick of this guy's tantrum.
That was Walsh on ABC's This Week. Walsh joins former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who's also running against Trump. On the Democratic side, we recently saw Jay Inslee, John Hickenlooper, and Seth Moulton all drop out of the crowded field. Tom Holbrook is a distinguished professor and Wilder Crane Professor of Government at UW-Milwaukee. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Well, as we check in on the latest, let's start on the Republican side. There is a category of Republicans, a lot of the leading intellectuals in the party over the last bunch of years, looking for a candidate to challenge Donald Trump in the primaries. From what we see in the polls, though, does President Trump look vulnerable to a primary challenge?
No, he doesn't. I think there's room there for somebody to come in and, you know, maybe get 10-15% of the vote. But challenging an incumbent president within his own party almost always ends up in failure. I mean, about the best case we've seen recently was maybe Pat Buchanan back in 92 or Ted Kennedy in 1980. These are tough things to do, especially because many of these same party insiders did all they could to stop Donald Trump from getting the nomination in the first place, and they weren't successful then.
and for that Never Trump movement, looking for a prominent candidate to challenge Donald Trump. Joe Walsh and Bill Weld, probably not that candidate.
Well, it's interesting because they're very different candidates, sure. Right? I mean, Bill Weld's a fairly liberal in Republican terms candidate, and Walsh is pretty conservative. You know, neither of them have the sort of national status that, you know, the Never Trumpers might be looking for. Maybe somebody more along the lines of John Kasich or Mitt Romney or, oh, I don't know, maybe Jeff Flake, somebody like that might do a somewhat better. But there, you know, there is this hardcore base of the, you know, 2019, 2020 Republican Party that really, really likes Donald Trump. And it's going to be very hard to make any serious inroads into him getting the nomination. Now, having said that, it's possible, you know, to do enough damage by challenging the president within his own party to hurt him a little bit more for the general election, which is in part what some of these Republican Never Trumpers are ultimately interested in, I think, is just not to see him get reelected.
But if I'm a Republican who hopes to have a political career in the future, this may not be a way to make friends among the Republican base challenging Donald Trump.
I don't know. It's interesting because let's suppose that Donald Trump goes on in 2020 and loses the election. I don't know if he's going to or not, but let's suppose that happens. And let's suppose it's a really, really bad year for the Republican Party because of that. And some of these people who stood up and challenged the president during this time, you know, at least in terms of the party apparatus, middle of the party, they may be looked upon more favorably.
Talking to Tom Holbrook, Distinguished Professor of Government at UW-Milwaukee, looking at some of the latest news in the 2020 presidential campaign. Switching gears for now to the Democratic side, we saw a few candidates drop out. Were you surprised by any of the candidates who have pulled out so far?
No, you know, I mean, there are so many of them. The ones who have dropped out might have made my list of the most likely. I don't know. I mean, there are so many that really don't have much of a shot at things right now that it certainly made sense for these people to drop out. It probably makes sense for others, certainly in the next couple of months, to drop out as well.
And we saw Washington Governor Jay Inslee. He had focused on climate change as the main issue for his candidacy. He had laid out a plan. He just finished laying out a plan for combating it before he dropped out of the campaign. Could a candidacy like that at least raise the profile of an issue like climate change among the remaining candidates?
Well, yeah, I mean, the one thing he did bring to the debates was his answer to almost every question got back to the issue of climate change. I think that, you know, most of the other candidates are on the same page as he is when it comes to climate change. But in the absence of his voice, it might get a little less attention during the debates. I mean, the Democrats, I think, just recently this past week decided not to hold a special debate on this topic. And if Inslee were still in the race, there might be a little more pressure to do that.
What kind of constituencies within the Democratic Party do you see this crowded field racing to try to capture here?
Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, in some ways, it's very much like we've seen before, where there's kind of a centrist standard bearer for the party. In this case, it's Joe Biden, who, you know, the middle of the road, rank and file Democrats recognize his name. He's got a history in the party, so they're supporting him. And then you've got the sort of more liberal wing of the party really being split between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and split about evenly as well, I might say. There don't seem to be really big divides in terms of sex. I mean, among the top candidates, Warren is doing somewhat better among women than among men. There don't seem to be any big racial divides yet at this point. It seems to be more a case of the liberal wing versus the more centrist wing of the party. And again, I think Biden clearly captures that centrist wing. Maybe Buttigieg picks up some of that as well. But in some ways, it's kind of a classic old Democratic primary where you've got, and I should say, really, this is what you see in the Republican Party normally also, where there's kind of a center conservative versus the very conservative wing of the party fighting it out in primaries.
And after that last primary between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, by the end there, there was definitely some bad blood afterwards from some supporters of Bernie Sanders. Do you think the Democratic Party can escape that this time around?
I think so. I think so. For whatever reason, and it's sometimes a little bit difficult to figure out, there was a lot of antipathy within the Democratic Party for the eventual nominee, Hillary Clinton, last time around. I don't see that among this group of candidates. I see... I should say among the supporters for these groups of for these candidates as well, I don't see quite the same sort of thing going on. And even back when it was Clinton versus Obama, you had the same sort of dynamic. I don't see that emerging here. It's of course difficult to tell what's going to. Nobody's cast a vote yet, but
right.
I don't see that happen. I don't see signs of that being an imminent. Outcome this time around.
Yeah, as somebody who studies elections, do we have a lot of prior cases where we have this many candidates running in a presidential primary? I know the last batch of Republicans, it was a big crew we thought at the time,
yeah.
But this is even bigger.
Yeah, no, there was a big group of Republican candidates last time around. I mean, I was thinking back, I think it was back in 1984, there were lots of Democrats coming out. It's strange to think about it now, but about early 1983, Ronald Reagan looked really vulnerable. So lots of Democrats came out and ran. 2008, there were quite a few Republicans coming out to run then. In fact, I was checking today, about this time in 2008, it seemed almost a certainty that Rudy Giuliani was going to be the Republican nominee. So it's sort of ramped up. It's clearly ramped up this year. And part of that, I think, is a sense that the president is vulnerable, and whoever gets this nomination has a good chance to become president. And for a lot of these candidates, why not? And give it a shot. Let's see.
Talking to Tom Holbrook, government professor at UW-Milwaukee, looking at some of the latest news in the 2020 presidential race. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a Republican or consider yourself mostly Republican-ish, do you like the idea of a primary challenge to President Trump? What do you think about the two options on the table so far, Bill Weld and Joe Walsh? Either of them have you excited, or is there someone else you'd want to see run? On the Democratic side of things, if you're somebody who usually votes in a Democratic primary, who is catching your attention? Do you consider yourself part of one wing or another of the Democratic Party? How do you see that shaping your interest in a candidate? What do you want to hear in either party from a presidential candidate to win your vote, whether in a Wisconsin primary or a general election in November 2020? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the 2020 presidential race with UW-Milwaukee professor Tom Holbrook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whatever your political affiliation or non-affiliation, is there a candidate you are liking so far in the field? Is there somebody you want to hear more about? What do you want to hear from candidates to win your vote? Who do you hope is still on a ballot to vote for when the Wisconsin primary rolls along? Call 800-642-1234. And what issues do you want to hear the candidates talking about? 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Tom Holbrook with us from UW-Milwaukee. And Tom, there's a temptation, I think, a lot of times in the media to look at how candidates are doing in the latest polls. There's a temptation to complain about the media talking about all the polls. What do you have your eye on? What do you encourage your students to be watching at this stage in a political campaign?
The polls, in part. You know, the polls have been fairly steady in a couple of ways. And one is the sort of identifying what appears to be a top tier of candidates, Biden, Warren, Sanders, and then a couple of others that might sneak in there, Harris and Buttigieg. So they've been fairly consistent in that way. But another indicator I think it's worth paying close attention to is fundraising. And those same candidates are the most successful among the fundraisers. Biden in the second quarter of this year pulled in about $22 million. Warren and Sanders around 18, 19. One thing that kind of stands out is Buttigieg pulled in about $25 million during that same quarter. So I think, you know, at least in terms of identifying that top tier of candidates, the polls have been fairly consistent. Now, having said that, I mentioned earlier that Rudy Giuliani was leading the pack by a wide margin about this time in 2008. 2012, it looked like Rick Perry was, you know, by in August of 2011, it looked like Rick Perry was clearly going to get the nomination. Hillary Clinton was up 20 points over Barack Obama in 2008. So
Scott Walker had a lot of buzz earlier in the last campaign.
Yeah, Scott Walker had a lot of buzz. Interestingly, I think in 2008, while Giuliani was in the lead, right about this time, Tommy Thompson had a real bump in the polls and was seen as one of the clearly viable candidates. So watch the polls, but be aware that they can certainly change between now and when the first votes are cast. And certainly from that point on, things can get really fluid as well.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hey there. You know, I don't consider myself a Republican, nor do I consider myself a Democrat. I would love to see a Republican challenge, a serious Republican challenge to our current president. Because I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat. Anything will be better than what we've got right now.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And that's a concern for Republicans that while Donald Trump's negatives, and there were a lot of negative views of him in the last election, they could actually come back to haunt him this time in ways that they didn't last time. Mark's an example of a case where backing that up, it sounds like.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think a lot of people share Mark's sentiment. One of the difficulties, though, is for a challenge inside the president's party to have any level of success, and by that I don't even mean winning, because I just don't see that happening. Besides the candidate, him or herself, you've got to get other party elites, and by that I mean mostly members of Congress or governors from around the country to get behind the candidate. I mentioned that Ted Kennedy had was an example of an attempt from within the president's party back in 1980, and you know he was more successful than most candidates have been since then. And part of his relative success was that he got other party leaders to endorse him and support him. And you know, I just don't see, I mean, Republican members of Congress have not exhibited a real willingness to stand up to the president. So I don't see, you know, whether it's Weld or Walsh or somebody else, I don't see the party elites really trying to get behind a candidate like that.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Getting back to negative views of candidates, we were hearing earlier in the show, actually, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton both had very strong negative views from the voting populace against them. And they ended up going, in many cases, with Donald Trump because they disliked Hillary Clinton more. Is that something you could see happening to whoever the eventual Democratic nominee ends up being? Or was there something special about Hillary Clinton and her long career in American politics?
No, I think Clinton was unique in many ways. And she, in some ways, it kind of reminded me of Al Gore in terms of the relationship with the general public. In that there was just something about her and something about Gore with people, broadly speaking, just didn't warm up to them. Their unfavorables, especially when they were running for office, tended to be pretty high. You know, I was looking at the Democratic candidates, and this is just among Democratic voters or prospective Democratic primary voters. One thing that kind of stands out is none of them have really high negatives within their own party. And that kind of gets back to one of the things I was talking about earlier, where I don't see the different wings of the party really sort of seething about the potential success of the other wing this time around. Some candidates are viewed more favorably than others, but there aren't a lot of really high favorables among this group of candidates. Now, that's within their own party. I'm not sure how the favorability ratings look among the general public, though.
Talking to Tom Holbrook from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the latest news in the 2020 presidential campaign. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'm kind of disappointed to see what seems to be the same kind of thing that happened to Bernie last time around, where the DNC seems to have put their thumb on the scales against Tulsi Gabbard. As an anti-war candidate, she's not popular with the establishment. But she was the number one searched candidate after both of the first two debates. So there's obviously a lot of public interest in what she has to say, but she's sort of been blacklisted as far as media attention. They're even selecting very selectively the polls that they will use to select ones where she does not meet the criteria.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. So Tulsi Gabbard, a representative from Hawaii, are running for president. Jim thinks she's getting an unfair deal from Democrats, Tom.
Yeah, it could be. You know, I think that she's a candidate who, especially on some foreign policy issues, the Democratic establishment is probably less interested in her being nominated than in other candidates. But, you know, I think Jim is right, though. If you look at her performance, especially in the last debate, I think a lot of people sort of thought, well, who's this? And part, one of the reasons there were so many searches for her name was because people didn't know who she was. But she had a nice, solid performance in that debate. So I'm not surprised to see that there was some increased interest in her candidacy. It also doesn't surprise me, and it shouldn't surprise anybody, that parties, Democratic or Republican parties, you know, they're interested in finding candidates who are going to win. And in 2016, they didn't see Bernie Sanders as that candidate. Hillary Clinton was the insider candidate. Insider candidates are always favored by the party, you know, whether formally or informally. So it doesn't surprise me that the Democratic establishment has favorites among this group.
Thanks for that call. Is there a case to be made from some of those outsider Democratic candidates that, hey, look, the Republicans resisted this outsider candidate? He won their primary. He ended up winning in the Electoral College.
Yeah, sure. You know, and that sort of goes under the heading of sometimes you just never know what's going to happen, right?
Fair.
Yeah, because really that seemed like the least likely possibility. And my real sense is probably heading off to watch the election returns that night, most people in the you know, hotel suite with Donald Trump did not expect that he was going to win that either. But, you know, and I suppose that one response to that is there seems to be some buyer remorse now, sort of not just within the Republican Party, but also nationwide on that front as well.
In our last few moments, Tom, what do you think a Democrat would have to do to stand out in the next round of debates?
Well, this is, you know, this is a difficult thing to sort of figure out. You got to get airtime first. You got to find a way to get the moderators to come back to you, and whether that's sort of trying to frame things in such a way that other candidates have to answer you and then maybe drop your name and then you have to be called upon again. Got to be forceful. You have to look like you know what's going on. You know, it also, you have to kind of hope that you're put in the debate with the right combination of candidates, because Sanders and Warren, you know, they suck up a lot of time. You know, they're really good at speaking. They're very articulate. The moderators seem to want to frame things about them versus the others. And this, by the same token, with Joe Biden also, whatever debate Biden's in, the moderators are going to sort of frame the debate as why.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Tom Holbrook from UW-Milwaukee. Tomorrow on Central Time, more of the top stories in national politics. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keeley Baltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, the census is a-coming. Keeley's guest says the 10-year population count is a really big deal, especially for rural parts of the country. Find out why tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then, what does it take to be an auctioneer? We'll talk to an award-winning Wisconsin auctioneer about how she got into the game, and I might do some fast-talking exercises myself. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network.